Well, as we gather this morning, we are staring out at the horizon of a new year, which is both exciting and daunting. You know, there's the blank canvas of possibility on the one hand, and on the other hand, there is the great unknown about what is ahead. We also are looking back on a full year that is now completely set in stone. What is done, and there is no going back. So how did you do? How was it in general? You know, how did you fare at the game of life in 2018? For some of you, it was a year probably of mostly positives. You know, new jobs, new homes, new babies, new relationships, new adventures. Your photo stream and your year history will be, you know, all smiles and giggles. But for others of you, it is one that you will never forget for quite different reasons altogether. Maybe broken bodies, and broken relationships, broken homes, and with those things, you know, a certain segment of broken dreams. So now what? I mean, what do you do with the fact that there is a blank slate that lies ahead of you in 2019? You know, for those of you who have suffered at the hands of 2018, maybe you want to raise the glass toasting, you know, to a better year to come. And for those who have had some success, I'm quite sure that you would like it to continue and maybe even see it improve. Our desire to move ahead or to be better off, to see better days, is natural to all of us. It's what we want. I mean, is anyone hoping for a worse year next year than the one that's behind us? Even as Americans, if we've had a great year, I mean, are we allowed to say, well, that was good enough, that will do, you know, and if it's just the same every year from here on out, that will be fine. We are programmed, you know, by nature for a desire for improvement. As one, as Stephen Fry, you know, mentioned as he was looking out at American culture, he says, if you go to an American bookshop, by far the biggest section is self-help and improvement. The idea that life is refinable and that you can learn a technique for anything, whether it's lovemaking or being a businessman or marriage or cooking, losing weight, whatever it is, there's a Tony Robbins way of doing it. There's a things they didn't teach you at Harvard way of doing it. There's an unbelievable sense that life is improvable. And that sense that life is improvable comes with no small amount of pressure. I'm sure you've felt it yourself a time or two, even a time or two today. In one article that's getting a lot of traction this year from The New Yorker, Alexandra Schwartz wrote Improving Ourselves to Death, a play on Neil Postman's title. And she, quoting other sources in this, writes this, that the self-improvement industry takes in $10 billion a year. Now, get your head around that number. The good life may have sufficed for Plato and Aristotle, but it's no longer enough. We are under pressure to show that we know how to lead, quote-unquote, the perfect life. So what do we need? I mean, what do you need? What does your life need? If you look at the problems of your life, what sort of solutions are you looking for? I mean, that's how the self-help industry makes its money. We think, well, all I need really is a little more information. If I just had information and techniques, then if I just had enough wisdom to gain the skills that I need or get some inside tips, some problem solving, that would at least help my life improve. But with that, we also, I think, realize that not we don't just need information. We need, in some sense, power to execute those things. You know, if I just had a little more power, if I just had an inside track, or, you know, if someone in my industry just knew my name, if my networking was improved just a little bit, if I just had a little more capital, then I could begin this or that venture. If I had more free time, or maybe if I could just get my one big break. You know, we want, on one, in one sense, just more information and better techniques, and in another sense, we want more power to execute our particular goals. And so you may be wondering how I can help you with this. And that's a good thing to wonder, because I'm wondering how I can help you with it as well. But the fact is, you do spend, you know, at least or close to an hour a week here, many of you, sometimes much more than that. So what can we, you know, as a church give you in 2019 that will be of service to you with the fact that there's this reality that life is before you and we all want something better than we've had? I mean, Paul, I believe, helps us along a bit with that here in 1 Corinthians chapter 1. I want us to see a few things here. Just first, what we want. Second, what we get. And then third, what we need. So first thing I want us to see is what we want. If you look in chapter 1 here, Paul informs us of a world waiting in expectation. And maybe more pointedly, a world waiting for self-improvement or an improved life. And that may not become immediately apparent to you, but if you look at the text, and you look, for instance, what he says here in verse 22 and following, Jews demand signs and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ. Paul is talking about what the world was waiting for. Notice the Jews are waiting for one thing, signs. The Greeks were waiting for another thing. They were waiting for wisdom. And he says, but what they got instead was Christ, and they got him crucified. But what does that mean? Why is it that Jews are waiting for signs, and why are Greeks waiting for wisdom? Well, because both of them are looking for an improvement to life. You know, when Paul says Jews are waiting for signs, he's using coded language. It's not that Jews were just interested in, you know, fantastic signs. You know, they weren't all David Blaine fans just hoping that there would be some man on the street that could hover or something. But they were looking for signs that would prove that the time of the Messiah had come. If they could just see the sort of signs that they had expected for God to send, it would mean that their day of salvation was surely on the horizon. For when Messiah comes, then so does the end of tyranny. When Messiah comes, so comes prosperity. You know, if you can get rid of your captors, you can be set free from captivity, liberated in your land, given a king who makes your life peaceful and well, then not only will you live at peace, you will live in prosperity, because you'll be able to go about your business without threats from the outside. Evil taxation won't be coming and, you know, taking all of your profits. There's this idea that when Messiah comes, he will rout our enemies, and he will give us peace in place of what we currently experience. You know, if you read the New Testament, you see this to be the case. Jesus says, for instance, in John, or they say to Jesus in John chapter 6, verse 30, what sign do you do that we may see and believe in you? What work do you perform? So notice, the Jews are there witnessing the ministry of Christ, and what they want from him is a sign, and the sign will then testify, you're the one that we've been waiting for. Again, Matthew chapter 16, the Pharisees and Sadducees came to him to test him, and they asked him to show them a sign from heaven. You know, signs were for them confirming powers, indicators that the one performing the sign has basically God's stamp of approval on him, as well as the power to rule and to liberate and to give them the things that they're seeking. You see a wonderful example of this early in John 6 when he feeds the multitude by giving them bread, and it says the whole crowd wanted to make him king immediately. Well, why? Because that's the kind of sign they were waiting for. And that's when Jesus decides to tell them, yeah, all you have to do is eat my flesh and drink my blood, and then you can have part of me. And it says, then everyone wanted to leave immediately. but they were waiting for signs, because signs would indicate that their Messiah had come in power to deliver them. But he also says, it's not just the Jews that were waiting for life improvement through a Messiah, according to Paul. So were the Gentiles. He says, Greeks were seeking wisdom. It wasn't a victorious king, necessarily, that would give bread that the Greek was desiring. It was a man of great wisdom, a philosopher that would teach one about the good life. If you look at the Corinthian church to whom Paul is writing here and the worldview of Rome that was currently abreast at this time in history, you would see that they had inherited the Greek mindset centered on this idea of wisdom or sophia, especially wisdom expressed through beautiful speech, you know, where we get rhetoric and so forth from. They wanted logos, logos to give them wisdom. And you can see this especially in 2 Corinthians when Paul is frustrated because it's like, man, any fancy talker you will follow, even if he has nothing to say, because it was such an ingrained part of their culture. They wanted wisdom, and they wanted wisdom that came in persuasive speech. I mean, think of the great Socrates who gave rise to his famous disciple Plato, or Aristotle that through his teaching gave rise to great men like Alexander the Great. Paul looks at the church in Rome who's inherited this sort of cultural heritage, and he's saying, you're seeking a great philosopher and a wisdom that comes through philosophy that will then give you the good life. He looks at the Jew and the Greek and he says that both, in a manner of speaking, are seeking salvation. And salvation in this context really is a life improvement scheme, which, again, salvation really is. I mean, we all want the good life, right? We all want betterment. And that's what salvation, in one sense, promises. The only thing that differs between the Jew and the Greek, according to Paul, is the method that they're seeking, right? The manner of the salvation that comes. Philosophy is salvation for the Greeks. You know, it's a way to escape the confines of this lower form of existence, to rise to a higher form of life. You know, the one who can contemplate, the one who can leave this earthly existence through contemplation will be a better man than the one who just goes about his daily tasks, never thinking about the larger things of life. A new Savior is looked for, whose teaching can help us get up and out of this normal plane of existence into that higher realm. Wisdom will surely save us. Signs for the Jews, because they testify to the one coming and his credentials, and wisdom for the Greek. Wisdom will save us for the Greek, and power will save us for the Jew. This is what they wanted, and this is what they assumed would help them along their way. But the question is, what did they get? That's what they wanted, and what did they get? What did God give them? Notice, Paul tells us, in no uncertain terms, they got the preaching concerning Christ crucified, verse 23. We preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to the Gentiles. They got a gospel, they got news, they got a speech about a Messiah, which seems like it would fit well. It is a message. That's what the Greeks want, right? That's what the Roman culture wants. They want a philosophy. They want a message. They want logos. And the Jew wants a deliverer. And Paul's saying, you got one. You got a Messiah king. So what's the message? Well, it's a message about Jesus, the teacher, and his mighty acts. And what are his mighty acts? He was crucified. I mean, that's what they got. They didn't get a powerful king leading an armed force. They didn't get a new philosopher waxing eloquently in the academy. They got a crucified king and a message interpreting that crucifixion. And that did not go over well at all. Paul says it's a scandal to the Jews and it's utter foolishness to the Greeks. So notice that the message, the Jews recoil. It's a stumbling block for Israel. They're seeking signs. And Jesus says, I'm not going to give you any signs save one, the sign of Jonah, that after my crucifixion, in 3 days, I will rise again. And as soon as he says this, he turns in the gospel and he begins marching toward Jerusalem, not to an enthronement that they were hoping for, but to an entombment to ultimately show this sign to be one that verified his messiahship. We demand a sign of power, and God says, here's your sign, a cross that exposes utter weakness. I mean, is there anything weaker or more foolish than that? It's the place of the criminal and the outcast, not the ruler that we're expecting to come. Even his own disciples, when he says he's going to go to the cross, are utterly scandalized. And that word, scandalized, as you read it in the New Testament, it's a stumbling block. It's something they trip over. It causes great distress for them. You know, Peter, the one who on this rock I will build my church, when Christ says he's going to die, Peter says, not you, not so, Lord, not for you. And when he speaks that way, he speaks the very words of the enemy, we're told. So the Jews are scandalized, utterly offended by the way that the Messiah comes, the weakness with which he comes. But the Greeks, they don't recoil, they just laugh. I mean, they're seeking a higher life, a plane of morality and knowledge that transcends the common. And what they're given is a crucified God who calls them to take up a cross and follow him. I mean, it's a new philosophy, all right. It's just a really dumb one, right? It's not that he isn't coming teaching something. It's just that the teaching is so ridiculous that who could possibly stomach it, and who would take even the time to consider it, much less follow it? It doesn't make sense. It's almost madness. I mean, this is what Dostoevsky shows so well in his book, The Idiot. in his, you know, modern day rendition of If Christ Were to Come to Earth. And through the whole story, every time this Christ figure encounters people, his folly is shown time and again until he ends his book committed to an insane asylum. You know, that is the way that the world receives the philosophy of Jesus. They set it aside as a madman's babbling. It's not for us. It doesn't work for in our particular case. Wisdom and crucifixion are utterly antithetical in the ancient world. You can't talk about criminal capital punishment and then say this is the highest form of thought and think you're going to get a hearing, you know, when you go down to the forum to talk about it. We need more information. We need a new philosophy. And what's odd is that things don't change. This isn't just something that's true of the ancient world. It's just true of this age. I mean, isn't this what we believe? You know, we just need steps to a better life. If we just had other principles of a new morality, if you just gave better advice or more exhortation and some steps to execute, then our lives would improve and we would follow you. And if you don't believe that's true, go back to those opening quotes. $10 billion a year says everybody believes that. I mean, this isn't a few kooks, you know, out in the back of the bookstore buying the stuff that's on sale. This is us as a people seeking the idea or believing the idea. If we just had a little more input and information, then we could improve our lives. If it's not information we need, then we need power, just like the Jew was seeking. I mean, don't we just need a help, a little bit of help up, just grant us the ability or an opportunity and we will achieve our goals. You know, more money, more connections, more positions. Just give us a place and we will use that place of power, you know, for good and for influence. We have real issues as human creatures that we believe need resolving. And what God gives us as a solution is a crucified Christ. And those things seem to be too far at odds for us to be able to stomach as natural man. Again, the problem is not that God offers a Savior. The Jews want one, and so do the Greeks. The problem is the manner in which the Savior comes and the method he uses to bring his salvation. I mean, if God were merely offering redemption from ills of the present existence, he surely would have gotten a lot more traction, at least in his first coming. Jesus could have maybe done a talk show circuit. You know, he could have had a podcast with a great following, could have written a book and got on the New York Times bestseller, Ways to Improve Your Current Existence. But the idea of, you know, take up your cross and follow me didn't quite have the same ring to it that the things that we seek do. It's the cross part that gets in the way. I mean, neither Jew nor Greek would be shocked if we were to say God's power is greater than man's power. Both believed such things. But if you say that the weakness of the cross is the display of God's power, both of them fold when they hear of it. It's just plain silly. I mean, it's a joke to the sophisticated, and it's utterly offensive to people trying to climb the ladder that what God gives us as a solution to our problems is Jesus Christ crucified in our stead. But that is what you get. And you get it because it's what you need. And that's what we want to see in our final point this morning. If you look in verse 18, Paul says it's the word of the cross that we're preaching that is folly. Verse 20 and 21, where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, it pleased God through the folly of what we preach to save those who believe. And then again in verse 23, we preach Christ crucified. God gives us a cross, but more than just giving us the cross, he says to everyone watching, this is my power and this is my wisdom. And if you want either, you have to find it here. Notice the progression. I mean, God calls out the age. You know, it's like he really is trying to start a fight. He says, you know, so where is the wise man? Where's the scribe? Where's the debater? I want them all to gather around because I've got something to say. And he says, didn't God make fools out of all of you and your wisdom? Since, notice, God in his wise plan made sure that through wisdom he would not be known. Paul is saying God makes foolish wisdom because he says this, all of your wisdom, you can use it all. You can use all of your schemes and all of your plans and all of your power, and you will never find me by using it. I will remain hidden from you. You can never climb to God through the wisdom of man. He will not be found that way. He refuses, as he says. It's in the folly of the message of salvation that he is willing to give himself to people. You won't find God in the wisdom of the world. But not just God, you won't find the salvation you're looking for in the wisdom of the world. I mean, everyone is seeking salvation. That's why we do all of these things. I mean, that's why they're, you know, if you want to know that you're seeking something, you know, think of all of your anxieties and your stresses and the ways that you push for place. You know, you are seeking something. But in all of our seeking, we always seek the wrong way. All of the ways of the world will never show you the way of God. All it will show you is your gaping need. God says, you know, I'm not going to let the wisdom of the world find me, but what I will let the wisdom of the world do is expose how needy the world is. That you can use all of this wisdom, and the only thing that it's going to get you at the end is a black hole of need that's being exposed as you keep using it and as it keeps falling short of giving you what you desire. I mean, think of the wisdom and the power of our age and what it's done to us. The message we have sold has come back to haunt us and bite us as a culture. I mean, instead of saving us, think of all of the destruction that has been done by our supposed good philosophies in this particular age. As one writer writes concerning our current dilemmas, parents continue to feed their children the loving, well-intentioned lie that there are no limits and that they can be anything, which then leaves their children blaming themselves rather than anything like the market's brutality or just lack of opportunity when they inevitably come up short. So notice what the author is saying. He's saying, you know, we meant well and we told our kids, there's nothing holding you back. You can be anything you want to be. And then later in life when they're not what they want to be, that it didn't work out just like we told them it would, they're left with this reality is that the only thing that could have failed was what? Me. Because there were no limits and I could have been anything I wanted to be. So if I'm not what I'm supposed to be, then I am to blame. So this intentioned power, this well-intentioned wisdom, all it does is expose the need in the person trying to make use of it. Or as another author writes, we brought happiness down from the afterlife, first to be an option, and then a mandate. So the idea of, you know, you only live once. Let's not wait for our happiness in the sweet by and by. You know, get all you can now, this, you know, you only live once mentality. And he goes on to say, in other words, this is your shot. Be all that you can be, or else. The end result is pretty grim. An ever-shifting, technologically amplified, improved self-society without any recourse for those who fail to meet their potential, which is all of us. So again, you'll notice, you know, live your best life now. The only problem with that is, at the end of it, you look back and you think, I missed, right? I didn't quite measure up to what I was seeking, no matter how much I tried to put, you know, a happy face on or, you know, present myself in such a way that all was well. In this promised life of improvement, achievement, success, and happiness, you will get all law, completely absent of gospel. There will be nothing for you if what you need is good news. The well-intentioned law of self-improvement will give you a goal to reach for that your life will continue to mock you concerning. Even those of you who have done pretty well so far. Because this old adage is true. If the self were improvable, then the self-help industry would cease to exist. I mean, if there's a book that you can read that will fix you, I mean, wouldn't everyone just read that book and be fixed? But why is it always, you know, it wasn't, and this is what happens, right? You get all of these methods for success, and what you will end up doing is we'll just blame the method. It's just that diet that didn't work. So I'll just do this other one, which will work. You know, and then it was that diet's problem. Because what those diets are showing us is what? The diet's not the problem. That there's a problem with us. And yet we don't want to admit that. So what we'll do, we'll seek more information, more wisdom, and wisdom will fix the problem. But wisdom keeps showing us that there is a standard to be met, and you're ever falling short of that standard. As the saying goes, you know, if you've quit smoking once, you've quit it a dozen times. Those kind of things really do mock your well-intentioned persistence. As one author writes, what's defeating is the belief that we can improve, help, liberate, redeem ourselves, but we just haven't quite managed it yet. And that's where loneliness and despondency truly come into play. And I dare say it applies to groups as well as to individuals. To be alive is to know this. It's just that hope in human resourcefulness is planned despair. Let me repeat that. Hope in human resourcefulness is just planned despair. So every time you seek a method where your hope is that if I just get enough either gumption, power, or enough wisdom, information, then I will succeed, you are just setting yourself up for a certain sort of despondency, you know, a certain sort of depression, because you will ever be failing to live up even to the standards you set for yourself. You can follow the logic here. It's precisely because human wisdom is unable to help you to reach God that God is utterly pleased to use a different message, a message that appears to be unwise to us. He says, you know, I've let you try human wisdom, and you kept trying to climb to me by it, but all it kept showing you is that you need something far greater than just a little help up. So I am pleased to use a method and to preach a message that can actually meet you where you're at. Something that actually answers the problem. Something where you are completely left out of the equation other than the fact that you have need. That your problem becomes your only contribution in this particular scenario. And because that's your only contribution, that becomes good news, because that's the only thing that you know that this year, as you face the year to come, it will still be there. Which means you're a perfect candidate for this particular method and the message that comes with it. God, they wanted wisdom and power, and what they got was a crucified king. And that's exactly what we need. I mean, who could have imagined Christianity, you know, a world religion that follows a crucified God? I mean, there's a lot of religions that make sense in the world. This is not one of them. And yet this is what God was pleased to give to us, because it's exactly what we needed. For the Jew, it's too offensive. I mean, it attacks everything they are. It's saying that they were no better off than anyone else in the entire world. What they didn't need was just another king to give them power. What they needed was a crucifixion, because they had problems far worse than those who were living in their land, far worse than people just living in their land. For the Greek, it's too foolish. I mean, just a bit of information is needed, a bit of moral reform, some better advice and counseling. Surely not death, not cross. It says to them that you are not wise enough, not smart enough to get a handle on the issues that you really have, and that all of their self-help will only show them that they need more help all the more. It says to both, and it says to you this morning, that this life is a losing game. You cannot win. You can try. You can try to game this system, and you cannot win. You've tried every year of your life, and you always pull up just a little bit short, sometimes way, way short. But all of it ends at the graveyard, right? None of us wins at this particular game. So if we're going to get something that's truly salvation, it has to be something that outlasts this life and removes us from this particular game, this particular struggle of trying to become something that is lasting and meaningful by our own powers. This life will make fools of us all. And what's crazy is that we're too foolish to even know it, to realize it, even though we've watched human history unfold, even though we've seen all of the world wars, even though we've seen all of our descendants before us pass from this age, even though we've seen everyone try and fail, we think somehow we can generate our own happiness, paint the perfect picture, and nothing can get in the way. Though all of us realize, as everyone around us lives in a veil of tears, we expect to live in some kind of wonderful bubble that will avoid all of those tragedies. And it's just not possible. It is a losing game. But God was willing to become a fool for us, a crucified God, in order to give us what we could not attain, to meet a need that we didn't even know we had. The cross isn't a good life coach. It's a death sentence. It's death to all of our schemes. It's a death to all of our power plays. It's an exposure of everyone that we are all in dire need. And it's an exposure of God and His kindness. That even though we had nothing to offer and no way to Him, He came to us and He granted to us something that we didn't even know we needed because of our sin. Something we were too blind to even look up and ask for. A salvation that gives us hope in this life. Comfort, surely, in the year to come. But hope that goes beyond this life, beyond the grave. And that is what we as a church, as a congregation, and a community want to be about. As Michael Horton writes, if we reduce Christianity to good advice, and it blends in perfectly with the culture of life coaching, it might seem relevant, but it actually lost in the marketplace of moralistic therapies. When we pitch Christianity as the best method of personal improvement, complete with testimonies about how much better we are ever since we surrendered all, non-Christians can legitimately demand of us, what right do you have to say that yours is the only source of happiness, meaning, exciting experiences, and moral betterment? Jesus clearly is not the only effective way to a better life or being a better me. One can lose weight, stop smoking, improve one's marriage, and become a nicer person without Jesus. What distinguishes Christianity at its heart is not a moral code, but it's a story. A story of a Creator who, although rejected by those He created in His image, stooped to reconcile them to Himself through His Son. As Isaiah says, "My servant shall act wisely. He will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted." And we learn through the Gospels that lifting up, that wisdom is the lifting up of a cross in order to redeem for Himself a people in great need. This is the wisdom of God, that in Christ and in His suffering we are healed, forgiven, and justified. As Paul says, He has become for us wisdom and righteousness and sanctification and redemption. We are in the sight of God, says Richard Hooker. We are in the sight of God the Father, as is the very Son of God Himself. Let it be counted folly or frenzy or fury or whatever. It is our wisdom and it is our comfort. We care for no knowledge in the world but this, that man hath sinned and God hath suffered, and that God made Himself the sin of men, and that men are made the righteousness of God. These things you lacked in infinite measure: righteousness and wisdom and sanctification and redemption. These problems could not be solved by any book that you can read or any power that you can muster. And this is what you need. This is what you will need, not just today, but for the whole year to come and the ones following that, because every other voice you hear outside of the gospel is telling you the very opposite. And what you need is what, you know, the old Pedro the Lion song says, you know, will someone please tell me the story of sinners ransomed from the fall? And that is, as a church, our commitment to you. We may not do a lot of things well, and we may not even do the preaching part of this well, but we promise this, that this is the only message that we'll preach. Because we know that whatever comes in 2019, both glorious and harmful, that this message counteracts them both and interrupts your life with a hope that is truly needed and an exposure that you need of what is really wrong with you. But also the exposure that God, in all of His infinite mercy, was willing to meet you where you were at and deliver you a salvation that you weren't even looking for, and to grant you hope in this present age, even when the future is uncertain. So let me close with a quote from Robert Capon. "The church is not in the world to teach sinners how to straighten up and fly right. That's the world's business. And on the whole, it does a fairly competent, even gleefully aggressive job of it. The church is supposed to be in the forgiveness business. Its job in filling pulpits is to find derelict nobodies who are willing to admit that they're sinners and mean it. It's supposed to take sheep who do nothing but be lost and stand them up to proclaim that lostness, deadness, uselessness, and nothingness are God's cup of tea. The church's job is not to go around implying that those desperate states are conditions we must get over as quickly as possible once we've been found. Its true work is to invite us all to go moonstruck over the news that one operative consideration in our life is the passion of the finder to find. May that be our hope and portion as we look back on 2018 and consider that thus far the Lord has helped us, and as we look forward knowing that the same God who has sought us and found us will be seeking us in the year to come, whether we be living in tragedy or whether we be, you know, his face be smiling upon us with blessing. Let us pray.